My name is Jerry Villiger. I'm one of the astronomy faculty here, and I'd like to welcome you to our fourth public astronomy lecture. And tonight's speaker is Dr. Chris Graney from Jefferson Community and Technical College. He's actually been an adjunct here as well. He started out his career, you were at Virginia, the University of Virginia, where you were working on stars.
Cooling flows and galaxies.
So he has a PhD in astronomy. And did you come here directly after?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. He came here afterwards to Louisville. And he's been here ever since for the last 20 years. He actually is writing books on the history of astronomy, which is something that we don't do here, but I wish we could. So actually, it's very good to have the contact with the history of astronomy. And tonight, he's going to tell us about Galileo and society back a few hundred years ago. So let's welcome Dr. Chris Graney to the University of Louisville.
Supposed to tell you that there's a guy in the back for extra credit sign up sheet for one of the astronomy classes. So,
James
Roche,
astronomy class.
All right. So, my name is Chris Graney, and I am a physics and astronomy professor at Jefferson Community and Technical College here in Louisville. And what a time to come here and talk about astronomy, especially the history of astronomy. Today is February the 24th of 2016. Now, I was supposed to talk in January, but U of L closed on account of snow on the day that I was supposed to be here. And so now, instead, I'm talking on the 400th anniversary of February the 24th, 1616. Now, what is special about that date? Well, on February the 24th, 1616, a committee of consultants for the Roman Inquisition assessed the heliocentric system as being foolish and absurd in philosophy. And so because of this date, I'm changing my talk just a little bit, so the focus is a little less on the strength of the science and a little more on the story. That's why I put the scratch marks through the subtitle there. Keeping the same title, but the subtitle is not quite as appropriate. Okay, you're going to learn some new stuff. This is based on recent research, namely mine. Okay, among other things, I got this image from the Vatican Secret Archives, previously unavailable. This is the actual image of a copy of the consultant's report from that day, February 24th, 1616. There is actually no sort of Dan Brown cloak and dagger stuff involved in getting this. How do you do it? You email the Vatican Secret Archives, you pay a small fee, and they send you a copy of a big 100 megabyte image file through Dropbox. So it's not very Hollywood. I translated the work of Francesco Ingoli, who I'm going to talk about for the first time, into English, and it was published in 2015 in the book that Jerry was talking about. And I tell you this because I think you should know that interesting work in areas like this goes on here in Louisville. Now, in my case, it's going on at Jefferson Community and Technical College, not U of L, but it's still in Louisville. And besides, I have a U of L connection. I've told Jerry, a long time ago, I adjuncted here for a couple summer classes. But right now, I am working with Delinda Bui, the professor and curator of the Rare Books Collection over in the Archives and Special Collections, right over there, okay? I'm working on the William Marshall Bullitt Collection in Mathematics and Astronomy. There is an original copy of Copernicus's De Revolutionibus right over there, okay, along with a lot of other interesting stuff, okay? So having a scholar just down the road helps out here at U of L too, even though I'm not actually at U of L. So in a week and a half, it will have been 400 years since on March the 5th, 1616, The Congregation of the Index, that's the office charged by the Pope with licensing and censoring books, issued a public decree which stated that the doctrine of Earth's motion was false and contrary to Scripture, and that to prevent the Copernican opinion from making further progress against truth, circulation of Copernicus's De Revolutionibus was to be suspended until offending material could be edited out of it. So, why did the Inquisition consultants state that heliocentrism was scientifically untenable, that is, foolish and absurd in philosophy? And why did the Congregation of the Index call heliocentrism false? Okay, what were those churchmen thinking, anyway? All right. Well, according to Galileo, they were thinking about the arguments of Francesco Ingoli. Okay. Now, and so, this is all the same image. That's a translation of sort of the central piece of it, and then this is sort of just putting it in short terms. Heliocentrism is scientifically untenable, and since it contradicts the literal sense of Scripture, it is theologically heretical. So, according to Galileo, what were they thinking? They were thinking of the arguments of Francesco Ingoli. Before we get to Ingoli, let's see how all this got started. It was started in 1608 by the invention of the telescope. After all, De Revolutionibus had been published in 1543. 7 decades had passed with no committees and no decrees. But the telescope and the discoveries Galileo made using it, like the phases of Venus that demonstrated that Venus must circle the sun, had made astronomy into something that was on the minds of people who probably would not have had astronomy on their minds otherwise. Okay, some such people were the powerful de' Medici family of Tuscany. Although this picture is actually this is a painting of Galileo showing the telescope to bigwigs in Venice, not in Florence. So, in December of 1616, Father Benedetto Castelli, a mathematics professor and one of Galileo's friends and followers, had breakfast with the de' Medicis. Grand Duke Cosimo II de' Medici, who was the ruler of Tuscany, asked Castelli if he had a telescope. So Cosimo's on the right, Castelli's in the middle there. Castelli said that he did, and that in fact the night before he had been observing Jupiter with its Medician planet. The moons of Jupiter, as Galileo named them. The mother of the Grand Duke, her most serene ladyship, Christina of Lorraine, she's on the left there, remarked apparently to herself that the Medician planets had better be real and not an artifact of the telescope. The Grand Duke asked another professor who was at the breakfast, Cosimo Boscaglia, about this. And Boscaglia answered that they were real, the moons were real, as were all of Galileo's discoveries. However, Boscaglia made the point to her ladyship that the earth did not move, and that the Bible stood contrary to the idea of its motion. So Boscaglia says everything that Galileo discovered is real, but the earth doesn't move. After breakfast, the de' Medici summoned Castelli back, and her most serene ladyship, Christina, ended up arguing against Castelli, citing the Bible against any motion of the earth. Castelli, who felt that her ladyship was challenging him largely to hear what he had to say, stood his ground despite being seriously intimidated by arguing among the rich and the powerful. The Grand Duke and his wife sided with Castelli, the younger de' Medici generations against the older de' Medici. On December the 14th of 1613, Castelli wrote a letter to Galileo about all of this. And we had that letter, that's where that information came from. My description comes right from Castelli's letter. Galileo responded to him on the 21st of December 1613, congratulating him. "What greater fortune can you wish," wrote Galileo, "than to see their highnesses themselves enjoying discussing with you, putting forth doubts, listening to your solution, and finally remaining satisfied with your answers?" No doubt he was hoping to get a research grant. Okay. So then Galileo offered a rebuttal to Her Most Serene Ladyship's biblical objection to Earth's motion. Holy Scripture can never lie or err, Galileo wrote. Nevertheless, its interpreters and expositors can sometimes err in various ways, such as by limiting themselves to the literal meaning of the words. Then, he said, one would have to attribute to God things like regret, hate, and ignorance of future things. Galileo may have been thinking of passages such as Genesis 6, 5-7, or Malachi 1:3. Scripture is written to accommodate the understanding of common people, he said, so it would be imprudent, quote, to oblige scriptural passages to have to maintain the truth of any physical conclusions whose contrary could ever be proved by us. The letter became popular among Galileo's followers and was copied and circulated. By February of 1615, a complaint had been filed with the Inquisition regarding the letter. However, a consultant for the Inquisition found that, except for some bad-sounding choices of words, there was nothing questionable in the letter. Galileo's name was cleared, but the Inquisition decided to ask its consultants for an opinion on the Copernican system, and thus the events of February the 24th and March the 5th of 1616. Now we return back to Francesco Ingoli. The Inquisition had... Let's see, I'm going to make sure I haven't left out any slides. Yeah, I forgot those guys.
Should we try to dim the light?
Well, that wouldn't be a bad idea.
Well, we can do that.
This is
not my home course. So.
Not bad. If it's not easy, don't worry about it. No, that's good. That's good. Okay. So we return back to Ingoli. The Inquisition had issued, they issued no formal action, no formal condemnation of the Copernican system. The consultant's assessment, that the document that I showed, was filed away. That's a whole another interesting story. Okay. The March 5th public decree by the Congregation of the Index is what Galileo knew about. That was the public action. In a 1624 letter to Ingoli, Galileo suggested that behind that decree was an essay that Ingoli wrote to Galileo 2 months prior to the decree. Quote, the arguments you, this is Galileo to Ingoli, the arguments you advanced were not lightly regarded by persons of authority who may have spurred the rejection of the Copernican opinion by the Congregation of the Index, he wrote. He noted that Ingoli's essay had circulated widely, and he wanted to make sure that no one thought, quote, that the rejection of Copernicus's opinion was based on a belief that you were right, that Ingoli was right. The historian Maurice Finocchiaro, one of the major historians on Galileo and the Galileo affair, at the University of Nevada, has written that Ingoli, a prominent Monsignor who would later be in charge of bowdlerizing the De Revolutionibus for the Congregation of the Index, quote, had probably been commissioned by the Inquisition to write an expert opinion on the heliocentrism controversy. Ingoli's essay, says Finocchiaro, had likely, quote, provided the chief direct basis for the recommendation by its committee of consultants that Copernicanism was philosophically untenable and theologically heretical. So, Ingoli's essay, this is the essay that Finocchiaro says is the basis for the rejection of the Copernican system, and that Galileo also says, that this essay is the basis of the rejection. Okay, so, what's in the essay? 22 anti-Copernican arguments. All right. Of these, 4 are what Ingoli called theological arguments. The other 18 he called physical or mathematical arguments. Ingoli's first argument is a mathematical argument regarding triangulating the distances to the sun and moon by observing them from different locations on Earth. Ingoli says the results of the triangulation are inconsistent with heliocentrism. Arguments 2 and 3 are mathematical arguments pertaining to how, were the Earth orbiting the Sun, there would be observable effects visible in the stars, and there are not. Number 4 is another mathematical argument, that Copernicus was wrong regarding certain technical details of Mercury's and Venus's orbits. Arguments 5 and 6 are physical arguments. Number 5 says that heavier materials move down, lighter materials move up. Number 6 says that in a circularly agitated sieve, shaken around like this, okay, heavier bits of material collect at the center. These two things suggest that the Earth, which is heavy, should be at the lowest point, that is the center, in a universe of circling lighter celestial bodies. Next comes two theological arguments. Number 7 concerns the words of Scripture, the sun and moon being equally described in Genesis as lights in the firmament. Number 8 is on the location of hell. Then comes a slew of mathematical arguments. A falling ball should deflect from the vertical, and launched projectiles should behave differently at different latitudes on a rotating Earth. These things do not occur, so Earth does not rotate. Number 11 and number 12 are more arguments about the Earth's motion being observable. Whoops, and I should probably move forward there. Number 11 and number 12 are more arguments about the Earth's motion requiring observable effects not observed on the stars. Number 13 is that Earth's motion should have an observable effect on daylight. Number 14 is that the observed motion of comets are inconsistent with a moving Earth. Number 15 through number 17, right, deal with how Earth maintains its orientation relative to stars so that we have a North Star, even though the Earth orbits the Sun. Copernicus attributed this to a third motion of the Earth. So in Copernicus's system, the Earth has one motion. First motion is revolution about its own axis. Second motion is revolution about the orbit about the Sun. Third motion is a motion counter to the second motion so as to retain the orientation relative to the stars. Ingoli's arguments were that all of this motion was unneeded, since Earth need not move at all. That's number 15. As well as complicated and physically improbable, that's 16 and 17. Right. Next comes three more physical arguments. Two relate to the idea of heaviness. Earth is heavy, okay, this is part of number 18, and hard to make move. Celestial bodies at the time were theorized to consist of a special lightweight element that moved naturally. Okay, astronomers do this, right? Something's happening out, you know, in space. You can't go there. Okay, something's going on. You invent a material to explain you say, oh, there's some material not found on Earth that's out there in the universe, and this makes all this stuff work. Dark matter, dark energy. That's the modern version of it. Okay, back then it was called fifth element. But it was a different idea. But it's still same basic problem-solving method. Okay, so the idea was that the celestial bodies would be made out of this special material. They'd be lightweight. They'd be easy to move. So the next thing is that heavy stuff moves naturally toward the center of the Earth, and so the Earth, being composed of heavy stuff, cannot move naturally around the Sun. The third, number 20, was that Copernicus lacked consistency in what he put into motion. All right, both a dark body like Earth and bright bodies like the planets are moving. And then the final two arguments are theological. Number 21 concerns the words of Scripture again, Joshua commanding the sun to stand still. Number 22 cites the words of a Vespers hymn, not to be taken lightly, and Ingoli warns. Cardinal Bellarmine likes these kinds of arguments. All right. So, now, Tycho Brahe. Turns out Ingoli gets many of these arguments from Tycho Brahe, the Danish astronomer. Ingoli cites Brahe's works complete with page numbers. He'll give Tycho page, book, page. Okay. Brahe had died 15 years earlier, but he had been the most prominent astronomer of the age. He had been lord of his own island, where he ran a huge astronomical research program with all the best instruments and all the best observers, all funded by the King of Denmark. Brahe had been an anti-Copernican. Recall Castelli's breakfast with the de' Medicis. Cosimo Boscaglia had asserted that all Galileo's astronomical discoveries were real. Okay, but he also asserted that Earth did not move. Boscaglia could have this cake and eat it too, because Brahe, impressed with aspects of the Copernican system, but rejecting the idea of Earth's motion, had developed his own system, like this. Okay, Brahe's system, the Earth is at the center, the moon goes around the Earth, the sun goes around the Earth, the stars go around the Earth, the planets go around the sun. Okay. Now, Brahe had calculated that the star, that were the stars as distant as Copernicus had supposed, so that Earth's orbit would be nothing by comparison, producing none of the observed, of the previously mentioned observable effects in the stars, then those stars would have to be enormous in order to appear as large as they do in the sky. Brahe measured their apparent sizes. Brahe could measure anything. He was an extremely good astronomer. Every last star, Brahe calculated, even the smallest, would dwarf the sun, and that, Brahe said, was absurd. Okay, this is what Brahe did. Okay, when you look up at the stars, they, as in this picture, okay, they have differing sizes. The more prominent ones look bigger. The less prominent ones look smaller. Okay, the name for the bigness of stars is called magnitude. Those of you who are in the introductory astronomy classes and you've learned about magnitude, you learned that they have this weirder thing where the bigger numbers, where the littler numbers mean the brighter stars. And you know, why is that? Here's why, okay, because they're like seeds in a tournament. Okay, the biggest and brightest stars, the first class stars are one. Second class stars, two. Third class stars, three. Fourth class stars, four. Fifth class, five. Sixth class, six. It's like first seed, second seed, third seed, fourth seed. Yeah, something like that, okay? That's why the numbering system works the way it does. Because it was, so the biggest stars were first magnitude. That's what magnitude means. Magnitude means bigness. So how did Tycho figure this out? Okay, like this. He says, okay, I look at a star. I measure its diameter. Okay, and then I look at like the moon. Okay, I look at it, and basically Brahe works out that a first magnitude star is about a 1/15 the diameter of the moon, as you see it in the sky. Moon and the sun appear about the same size in the sky, so a star looks about a 1/15 the diameter of the sun in the sky. Okay, that means that for the star to be the same size as the sun, it has to be about 15 times further away than the sun is. Okay, now, all right. In the heliocentric system, okay, the annual motion of the Earth around the sun should be reflected in the stars. That's called annual parallax. That's one of those effects that Ingoli is talking about that I just breezed through in his list of arguments. He gives them more detail than I did. There should be annual parallax. There's none that anyone can see. Okay? And so the Copernicans argue, why can't we see that? Because the size of the Earth's orbit is so tiny compared to the distance to the stars that the Earth's orbit is negligible by comparison. As Copernicus said, this proves their immense height. Every visible object has some measure of distance beyond which it is no longer seen, as is demonstrated in optics. Okay. Well, here's the problem with that Brahe worked out. Look. If you have an object that has a certain size, like that star, okay, but then you go and say, no, that is not this far away. It's hundreds and hundreds of times further. Then, when you make something of a given size further away, you require it to be bigger, okay? So that the further away, and you see, say, further and further away means bigger and bigger and bigger. Okay? So Brahe works out, look, in the Copernican system, those stars have to be really, really far away. He calculates they have to be 700 times further away than Saturn to have no measurable parallax. Okay? That Saturn's about 10 times further away than the sun, so that's 7,000 times farther away than the sun to have no measurable parallax. Okay? Remember, based on his measurements, if the stars were to be the size of the sun, they'd have to be 15 times as far away. They're 7,000 times as far away, which means if they were 15 times as far away to be the size of the sun, 150 times as far away to be 10 times the diameter of the sun, 1,500 times further away to be 100 times the diameter of the sun, 7,000 times further away is going to be several hundred times the diameter of the sun, is how big a star has to be.
Okay.
All right. So, Brahe said this is crazy. Okay. By contrast, in Brahe's system, the stars are right past the planets. Saturn is 10 times further away than the sun is. Stars are a little bit past that. 15 times further away, remember, makes the star the same size as the sun. So, they're not quite 15 times as far. They're a little bit smaller than the sun. Okay? No problem. Okay, so, stars are not so different. Distance. In his system, the sun, moon, and stars circle an immobile Earth while the planets circled the sun. The stars lay just beyond the planets. It did not have to be so huge. In Brahe's system, celestial bodies all fell into a consistent size range. So, this is Brahe's calculation of, that's the sun right there, little that. This is the size of a typical, of an average-sized star in the Copernican system, according to Brahe. Okay, this is the Copernican system right here. So, Brahe says, look, every star has to be just huge like this. Okay. Whereas, by contrast, in my system, says Brahe, everything works out nicely. Okay, here's the sun, there's Mercury, there's Venus, there's Earth and the Moon, Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn. Those are the actual sizes that he calculated out, the actual relative sizes. And then this is a first magnitude star and a second magnitude. No, sorry, first magnitude and third magnitude. Okay? All the celestial bodies fall within a harmonious, reasonable, consistent size range between the moon being the smallest and the sun being the biggest. Right? By contrast, he said, in the Copernican system, this is stupid. All right? And he said, that's that whole diagram that I showed there against one third magnitude star. A first magnitude star I didn't put on here because it's so big, it just looks like a straight line. Okay, you could hardly even see the curve. Even a tiny sixth magnitude star completely dwarfs the not only the sun, but a good chunk of the whole solar system. Okay. Brahe thought this was nuts. Right. So, of course, Ingoli brings this up. All right. The star size issue is a solid argument for Tycho's system. And Ingoli brings up the star size question right after his arguments number 2 and 3. And, of course, he cites Brahe by page number. All right. Galileo's discoveries are all fully compatible with Brahe's system. Anti-Copernicans like Bisgaglia could accept Galileo's discoveries, like those phases of Venus that proved it to circle the sun, because in Brahe's system, Venus circles the sun, which in turn circles an immobile Earth. Okay, so you say, telescope shows that Venus circles the sun. In the Copernican system, Brahe says, yeah, Venus circles the sun in my system too. Okay. And I don't have giant, huge stars. Okay. Anti-Copernicans like Bisgaglia could cite Brahe's arguments and his scientific authority against Copernicus. I'm not going to analyze the validity of the 18 mathematical and physical arguments here. Some of them, like the star sizes, were solid, or would have seemed solid granted the knowledge of the time. Some of them were weak, even granted the knowledge of the time. What is clear is that Ingoli's challenge to Galileo, the essay that Galileo believed to have been influential in the action of the Congregation of the Index, was a challenge about matters of science. Okay. This is especially true since Ingoli suggests to Galileo that he ignore the four arguments about religion. Okay. Respond, says Ingoli, to whatever arguments you wish, but at least to the better ones among the physical and the mathematical arguments. So, what were those Inquisition and Congregation of the Index churchmen thinking when they rejected the system of Copernicus? Apparently, they were thinking about the same thing Bisgaglia was likely thinking about when he was with the de' Medicis, Tycho Brahe. How can you go wrong siding with the greatest astronomer of the age? And you don't even have to mess with the literal words of the Bible to do it. they probably thought that the decree of March 5th, 1616 was just a no-brainer. They did not stand with Galileo, and I think that you would not have stood with him either. You would have stood with this guy, Tycho. Okay. Now, I'm going to take a minute for some questions, and I have a few closing remarks about that, sort of the, like the applicability of this. But the thing I need to bring in is to mention at the end is that the apparent sizes of stars, the magnitudes, turn out to be an illusion. Okay, stars. You go out and look at back. There. You go out and look at the sky. It looks like this. Okay, bright stars look big. First magnitude stars look bigger. Sixth magnitude stars look like little pinpoints. Okay, this is correct. And if you take an unbiased person who doesn't know anything about, who doesn't know better, who hasn't been taught otherwise, somebody who knows how to make measurements, especially like somebody who works in construction or something like that, knows how to, they will walk out and you say, look up at that star. How many of those would take to fit across the moon? And they'll come up with that 10, 15, 20, something like that. They'll come up with the same values Brahe did. Because Brahe came up with the same values that like Ibn Sina came up with. Okay, who came up with about the same values that Ptolemy came up with? Because that's what it looks like if you have good eyes. If you have bad eyes, they look like fuzzy balls. Okay, if you have good eyes, they look like little round dots. Okay. It turns out that those round dots are illusions. Okay, they are caused by a phenomenon involved in diffraction and seeing and a bunch of other complicated stuff that would not get worked out until at least the astronomers would not begin to figure out that the sizes of stars were not actual physical sizes until at least 50 years after all this goes down. That's the beginning. Okay. Not 100 years after that goes down do they actually start hammering it out and really believing that, no, those where it starts to become accepted that those are not actual size stars, star sizes. But if you've ever heard of the Cassini division in Saturn's rings, Cassini is in the like 1716 is arguing for is measuring the size of Sirius as what it looks like as being its actual size. So that's even 100 years later, there's still a very prominent astronomer taking the sizes of stars as being what they appear as being a representation of their physical size. So that has to get worked out. They have to figure out that the star sizes are not real before Tycho's argument falls apart. Okay. Otherwise, you're stuck with, if you're a Copernican, you're stuck with this. Okay. So, now, like I said, I got a couple more things to comment on, but at this point, I'm going to take questions, and I'll see how time goes, but I have a few closing comments about sort of the applicability importance of history of science. So. Now, Jerry, what time are we out of here? We're done at? Like
8:30 after all the questions that we had.
What time
we
is
don't
it?
Have a fixed time, but around 8:30 probably.
And what time is it right now?
About 8:05.
Okay, so we'll take a few questions. I got some closing stuff.
Sure.
If anybody's got it. Yeah.
Okay. The eye thing with Google gets bigger and bigger, and he realized 700,000. How far off, if he would have just believed himself, was he from a correct figure?
Okay. All right, let's look at, basically what he's calculating, 7,000 times the further than the sun is like 7,000 astronomical units, okay? And the stars are at more like 150,000 astronomical units. So, I mean...
What I'm saying is that he said they're getting bigger and bigger, so it wouldn't have to be that much further, and he just wouldn't believe that.
Yes, he would not believe, he did not...
So if he would have followed that train of thought, he might realize, he might have been able to calculate.
Calculate what? No, he is looking. You can't calculate the distance if you think that the star sizes you're seeing are physical bodies. Okay, they are.
Well, no, I believe that. I'm just saying that he, in his argument against the other, is saying that the star to be that big and the other one not, he's mathematically taking it out further and further and further, but he did it as to discredit and he just fought him.
No, I mean, so the Copernicans believed him. Right? Tycho is NASA. All right. Galileo is a guy with a telescope. Copernicus is some guy working in a cathedral. He's got a cross staff for measuring distances. Galileo has oodles of money, biggest observatory. He's the baddest ass in astronomy. Tycho. Tycho is the biggest badass in astronomy. Okay. His measurements are as good as it gets. You can't argue with his measurements, and his calculations are just basic geometry.
Does he have a telescope?
No, he doesn't have a telescope. Okay, there's no telescope. So the you can't argue with him. His logic is correct, right? I mean, if the Earth goes around the sun, there's got to be parallax in the stars. Has to be. You move, there has to be an effect. The only way there cannot be an effect is if the stars are really far away. If the stars are really far away, but they have a certain size that we see, 1/15th the size of the sun in the sky, but they have to be 7,000 times further away than the sun to have no parallax, because he can calculate the parallax. He's so good at measurements, he knows he can get it if it's like less than half a minute of arc or something like that. You know, he knows he's got it. You can't argue with the geometry, you can't argue with measurements, you just have to accept it. Okay? So the Copernicans, this is something that's generally not well understood, is that lots of Copernicans looked at that and said, okay, I buy that. Okay, and you know what their argument was for why that was okay? It's because God is powerful and he can make big stars if he wants. That's the argument. And Tycho said, I don't believe that that's a good scientific argument, is that, oh, God is powerful, so that's the solution to our problem. See, Tycho looked at this and he said, look, your problem is, to put this in more modern terms, Tycho viewed the faraway stars as an ad hoc solution to solve a problem with a theory. The theory says there should be parallax. There is no parallax. So the Copernicans, in Tycho's view, speaking as Tycho, the Copernicans just take them and stick them way out far away. Say, oh, they're going to be parallax because they're far away. Then he goes and calculates that they're really big, and they say, oh, okay, they're really big. God can make them big if they want. You know, but he does not think that that is a good scientific argument. He has a very persuasive case. Tycho is a very good scientist. Yeah.
And the size of the stars would have been partially affected by the diffraction through the atmosphere. You can't get a very accurate size that way.
Well, you can if you're Tycho.
Well,
you can. You know, one of the things that's very difficult to understand is how much time a person would spend. Tycho knew about the atmosphere. He spent a bunch of time trying to triangulate the distance of Mars to test whether the Copernican theory... Tycho was open to the Copernican theory being right. He spent a bunch of time trying to triangulate the distance to Mars because in the Ptolemaic theory, Mars could not be closer to the... Mars always had to be further away than the Sun. And in the Copernican theory, it could be closer. So he figured if he could triangulate and prove that Mars came closer to the Earth than the Sun, he'd prove that Ptolemy was wrong and Copernicus was right. Then he realizes he can't do it because of atmospheric effects. So he is, you know, this is a guy who is getting a hoard of money for, you know, to do astronomy and can hire all the best assistants. Johannes Kepler is an assistant hired by Tycho Brahe, as are quite a few other very prominent people from that time. And he's just really good. He knows about the atmosphere. He can measure down, you know, at least pretty well. It's just that he's measuring something that's actually there, but it's not, I mean, any light that passes through an aperture forms what's called an airy disk, forms a size. There's no thing in that, you know, no true pinpoint in optics, okay, that, you know, that is seen or detected with a camera or a telescope. So he can make those observations. He's before the telescope. He dies in 1601. Telescope is 1608.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
No,
he dies in 1601. The telescope doesn't help. The telescope confuses the heck out of everybody because they look through the telescope. That's a whole different story. This guy has a question.
He's from the earliest forms of the sextant. When was the sextant invented? All that was triangulation that U.S. Naval School taught us a few years ago.
And they're going back to teaching it. It's just on the news. I heard it on the news yesterday because they're worried about the reliance on GPS and electronic warfare screwing up that system. So they're teaching people again how to do the celestial navigation. But continue.
Poxwire is the only organization right now that teaches that, and it's a free book, of course. But the story is that you needed to know it just in case your GPS battery went dead.
Yeah. Tycho has, I mean, his instruments are all sort of celestial measuring instruments. They're in a sense like big glorified protractors of various sorts. There's one. Okay. So this is very stylized, but here's one, and it's measuring here from 0, 20, 30, 40, 60, 70, 80, 90 degrees. It uses these little diagonal lines back and forth as you slide an arm along measuring distances and sizes on the sky. But he doesn't have a telescope. But the telescope doesn't solve the star size problem, or else Cassini wouldn't be arguing about it in 1716. Yes?
How long did it take you to translate all that?
A long time. Well, wait a minute. Ingoli's letter is not... So this is the weird thing about this stuff, okay? This, you think that, well, I mean, this is this famous story. Everybody ought to know this stuff, right? Okay? This is the first... You're not going to find a copy of that anywhere, okay? Where are you going to find it? From me, okay? And you'd think to yourself, well, surely, this is like, well known. No. It's part of what this all boiled down to where there was a certain punctuation mark in this thing. Okay, this guy Funicciari, he says in a book, there's a semicolon after this. He says basically this is two statements, foolish and absurd in philosophy or scientifically untenable, one statement, contrary to the Bible and heretical in another. Okay, a lot of these translations say that it's foolish and absurd and foolish and absurd and heretical, all because it's contrary to the Bible. It's not. It's foolish and absurd. Science is bad because they believe Tycho, and contrary second. You look through and found that a dozen different sources that give it, and they all give different punctuation on this. You know, and so the only way to get, I asked Finocchiaro, I said, okay, you sure about this? You know, because I can't find anything else. He's like, yeah, I'm sure about this. Do you have a copy of this? No, I don't. You know, so it's just, you know, I was like, okay, I'm going to try just asking the Vatican if they'll send me one. Yeah, you know, that'll be $10. And then that was it, you know. But you would think that would, you know, that'd be known. It's not. Ingoli's letter was never translated until last year, you know. And another thing that I'm working on is a translation of this thing by this guy Locher. I just found out yesterday that it's going to get published. And Galileo makes great fun of him, but turns out his arguments are really good, and he's got the star size argument in there. He doesn't say Venus doesn't circle the sun. He's got Jupiter and its moons, and he shows how to calculate where the eclipses of the moons are and how to use this to triangulate the distance from the sun to Jupiter. And he suggests, you know, a couple of research projects, all this stuff. Really smart guy, you know. But Galileo makes him look like an idiot, and we all and that's pretty much what we've all followed. You know, and it's just amazing. Ingoli's thing did not get published until like the 19th century, but has never been translated. You know, it's weird. And the reason you can do all this stuff is because it's all been posted on the internet in the last 20 years. So, you know, before you'd have to go to some library in Europe, you know, and they'd have to let you into the special vaults and all this other stuff. And now most of the libraries just have stuff, you know, they have all their collections digitized. There's oodles of stuff just on Google Books. You know, you go to Google Books, type in a specialized search. Say you want to limit your search to prior to 1600, and you'll come up with a whole bunch of books that are published in the 14 and 1500s, full copies. Okay, they look like crud, but you know, that you can read them.
Something else too, he was given some grace, I think, in 1616. He had to rewrite the book not as a proof of that he was right, but that there were scientific evidence and arguments for both heliocentric and geocentric. But what he did was he created a character in that book called Simplicio. And Simplicio in Italian is simple.
Yeah.
And so the simpleton believed in the geocentric. And that turned him on him again because now he was advocating.
Yeah, that gets into a whole different ball game in 1630 after, you know.
Star size, if you look with your eyes, can change depending on the conditions in the atmosphere. If you have a lousy night, they'll look like fuzzy tennis balls. If you have a great night, they'll look better to your eye, they'll look terrific. So I assume Tycho knew about this sort of stuff. They just took the best night and
The best nights and the best observers. There's stuff that, you know, it's very fun to read these things, okay? I had to relearn Latin to read this stuff. But it's really cool because you know that nobody's read this stuff in ages. And, but yeah, they sit there and, you know, it's like, yeah, we know, okay, look, you know, you can't get somebody with bad eyes to do this. People with bad eyes think all stars look like tennis balls, you know. So they say you only have to have the most eagle-eyed people to do it. And then you have to do it when the air is the stillest and so on and so forth, you know. All right, I want to ask some more, if there's more questions, Kim, but I want to give you, so other than a little historical stuff, so I'm going to give my spiel about why history of science matters. Okay, so, boom. All right, YouTube. Okay. Like Professor Williger, I teach an introductory astronomy class, and once, and for a little assignment on, doing moon phases with a ball and a light, I wanted to show some stuff on YouTube. I go to YouTube, I type up in YouTube, moon phases, okay? A simple, innocent search. Moon phases. What could cause anything bad about moon phases? Okay? Hit moon phases. Call up Bill Nye, the science guy, right? He's the, you've got, those are like paid, right? Yeah, ad. And Bill Nye, science guy's moon phases videos. First, he's exactly what I'm looking for. Bill Nye, moon phases. No problem. Okay, call it up. Wait a minute. What's this? Aliens on the moon. Truth exposed 2014. We never went to the moon.com. Fake moon landing totally. What the hell crashed on the moon, NASA, and why are you still... Okay, you just imagine. A kid goes, clicks moon phases, clicks on it, and here's this stuff. Of course, and you can't resist clicking all the junk that comes up on YouTube. All right. Now, this is my opinion. My opinion is that history of science myths are central to the problem of science denial. Okay? That's science denial. We never went to the moon. Okay? I know that there's enough people in this room that there's at least three people in here who will give credence to the idea that we never went to the moon. There might be 10. Okay? You won't admit it. Okay? And maybe they will admit it. All right? Now, let me tell you, that speaking from my opinion, that voodoo would be a better thing to believe in than that we didn't go to the moon. But I'm not going to convince you of that if you believe it. History of science myths are central to the problem of science denial. You've heard of vaccine problems. It's a great list. Moon, the vaccines, you name it. Okay? You see, in my opinion, science deniers see themselves as Copernicans, standing against those who refuse to go along with the truth. All right, that's the typical thing. The Copernicans had it right, and they had reason to believe that, and they were opposed by a bunch of thick-skulled obscurantists, blah 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 blah, geocentrists. The Earth's got to be at the center because we got blah whatever. Okay. All right. In fact, of course, and that is the thing. Look, to point to Copernicus, point to Galileo, and see, we're just like Copernicus. We're just like Galileo. We know the truth, and all the dark forces are against us, just like Copernicus, just like Galileo. But, of course, that actually wasn't what happened, okay? What happened is that the people who were against Copernicus and Galileo, they were basically with Tycho. They were with the biggest, baddest, best astronomer of the time. They thought that they were right, okay? And they had good science to back them up. They had good arguments. They weren't just sticking their fingers in the air and going, I don't want to hear it, okay? And that's how science works, okay? Science is not a process in which somebody comes up with the truth and a bunch of big bad guys try to cover it up, okay? It wasn't then, and it wasn't now. Okay, if we didn't actually go to the moon, you'd actually be able to come up with real evidence of that, other than, like, oh, look, the flag doesn't hang right, or whatever, it does this, or, oh, the shadows don't line up properly, all that stuff that people come up with, or the stuff about the vaccines, okay? And that's how science works, is that you have, a theory, and you have another counter-ideas, and you have smart people who come up with a strong counter-argument, and it has to be slugged out through a long, arduous process where you do things like figure out that, those star sizes, they're actually not real. Okay? How do you figure that out? How do you figure out that stars aren't the right size? They're not what they look like. Because you watch the moon pass in front of them. Instead of the moon passing over them gradually, it passes across them and then they wink out instantaneously. And that's when people first begin figuring out that, those star sizes aren't actual. It's a very tough process, but that's boring and that's tedious and all that stuff. And so you get this idea of, this conflict, which shows up in the science denial. And so my opinion is you've got to know that the history of science to understand how science works, or we'll be fighting this moon denier junk for the next trial. And
moon
denier. Yes.
Sorry, I came in here. But in the arguments that were made, did he, I guess, the atomic process in the start, did he use any, I guess, trigonometric functions to help, like, define it, like, the size of it? And I guess the second part of that question is, I guess if he used, like, that basic conceptual math, what type of procedures did he do, I guess, on Earth? Or try to repeat to showcase that same example, like the idea of how you said, like, the moon has a
okay, I don't have a board. Okay. This is gonna be one of these hand waving things. Couple of things. So you're asking like, you know, how do they use trigonometry to figure this stuff out, right? Is that sort of the short story?
Like some of the earlier scientists are like, okay, distance to like the angle where you see stars, like if it was such distance.
Right. Okay. So basic. I mean, you know, it hardly even amounts to trigonometry. That I mean, that is, you know, my younger son came up with the example that, you know, when you, I was trying to think, how do you explain this to people who are like, you know, don't want to sit and listen to a whole bunch of drawings and diagrams. Imagine, you know, in Superman movies, right? Where someone says, "Look, it's a bird. It's a plane. No, it's Superman." Right. Okay. All right, you got three people. No, it's a bird. No, it's a plane. No, it's Superman. These three people. First person thinks it's a bird, thinks it's something that's small and close by, right? Because they're all seeing the same thing. The person who thinks it's a plane is thinking he's seeing something much larger, therefore much further away. And then Superman, it's in between. Okay, so they're all seeing the same thing, but based on how far away they think it is, they imagine it bigger and bigger. Okay, so that's the sort of simple thing behind that. Okay. Yeah, angular size. That's this. Okay. Now, for like just basic distance measurements, the way they would do it is you would, you know, like Tycho to measure distance, you'd say, well, you have a person at this place on Earth, a person at this place on Earth, and they both make a measurement up to, say, the moon or something like that. And from that, from their both drawing, you know, making a slightly different angle, they could then, you know, draw out the triangle and use trig to figure distance. That's actually, even now, remains the only direct distance measurement to anything out in space. And we can use radar or laser ranging to like Jupiter, like the moon. I think we can bounce radar off of Venus. If you want to know the distance to a star, the other way to do it is triangulate. Parallax, and what's the satellite that did up the Hipparchus satellite?
Gaia.
Yeah, you know, so that this is how you measure. This is how you do direct distance measurements in space. You have to have two different views and triangulate. Yeah. And that's, you know, if you look at the math in their works, it's really tedious because they don't have a lot of, like they don't have algebra worked out yet. You know, so they like have to talk out. Imagine what algebra would be like if you had to describe it all in a paragraph or something. And it's just, you know, and then they don't use decimals, you know, so everything is like five, like the sizes of the stars are like, this measures 2 and 127/358 of a minute of arc or something like that. You know, it's rough, but it's not complicated. I mean, it's stuff that you get in high school, so you don't have to know real high mathematics to solve this stuff, but it can be tedious.
That tells you exactly where you're at, that's for sure.
Yep.
Miles, but it's an issue of you got to have a horizon that's straight out on the water, approximately about a mile and a half, because that's where the Earth starts to turn, and beyond that they don't count. Then you take the moon, for instance, or any one of the planets. Take the upper and lower limb, like the top of the upper limb, take a reading off of that, and then you follow whichever planet that's going across the sky, and then you've got to go to an astronomical almanac. And it's the book actually.
Right.
And then you're sitting here trying to figure out what on the daylight saving time or throughout math.
But in why it is tediously complicated. The math isn't like really sophisticated. You know, you don't need to know. It's high school math, but just involved.
As this is a working night, class night, academic night, school night. I don't know. Do we have any people from high school, sir? Okay. Yeah. All right. So don't want to keep you too late. I'd like to thank Dr. Chris Graney again for coming. You can come on down and talk to him individually.
I would like to put in one more plug. Okay, if you are not